Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner, and it's a great pleasure to welcome back for part two of two. We actually had a part three of three a few months ago, but in this case, it's not a musical topic, so it's part two of two. We're going to have talk, and we will have music as well, with John Barr. John Barr is a poet, a wonderful poet, and the author of eight published collections of poetry, including most recently the box set, the two volumes of The Adventures of Ibn Opsit, I-B-N-O-P-C-I-T. You all can start thinking about where those words come from. Grace and Opsit at Large are the volumes. Red Hen Press from Pasadena, California are the publishers. And John Barr is also, at least while we're speaking, still the president of the Poetry Foundation. He has been president of the foundation for about a decade, and at the end of June, he takes off, and his successor, Robert Polito, P-O-L-I-T-O, comes in. And around the same time, there's a changing of the guard at Poetry Magazine, published by the Poetry Foundation. Chris Wyman, W-I-M-A-N, Christian Wyman, ends his decade-plus as editor of poetry, and Don Scher, spelled like it sounds, succeeds him, currently senior editor of the magazine. So we're going to have a time of change, but also a time of very logical transition and connection. Last week, we talked with John mostly about his own poetry, his own background, and how he came to lead the foundation. And we thought this time, let's talk about those 10 years of building up the foundation, building a building, other projects, and where things are going to go from here, both in John's own work and in the world of poetry at large. After all that introduction, welcome back, John Barr.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. I'm happy to be here.
We talked last time about your getting a call from a headhunter search firm, interviewing with the board of what was then called the Modern Poetry Association, I believe.
Yes.
And then taking this job as first president of the Poetry Foundation after the foundation had received a gift that grew out of a back-and-forth friendship and editor, non-publisher of the submitted poems from by Ruth Lilly in Indianapolis, from the Lilly family, Joe Parisi, former editor of the magazine, a gift that grew to amount to about $200 million and that has made so much possible, but also must have presented enormous challenges. So what happened then when you arrived back in Chicago to take up this challenge?
It was a cold winter day in 2004. Yeah. And I had an overnight suitcase, and I showed up, and I went to the current address of the Poetry Magazine, and it was kind of like a cold water walk up, located over a health club, and very quiet because I was the Wall Street guy and they wondered if I was the ogre that was going to fire everybody and get things right.
Start counting lines with those poems.
And so the first thing to do was get acquainted and break the ice. And we had a few pizzas and discovered that we were actually all human beings. And we started together to look at the question of what to do with this incredibly generous gift from Ruth Lilly. I think I mentioned earlier that she had no letter of wishes or instructions, no restrictions. And that is a rarity in the world of major philanthropy. Usually people want something named after them or they want a bunch of rules about how the money's used. This was a classically clean experiment. Here's a bunch of money. Here's the world's greatest poetry magazine. And what happens next?
We should just mention for history's sake that cold water flat over the health club had emerged in the initial days of that gift, that the magazine had a more prestigious street address but even smaller quarters at the Newberry Library.
Correct.
For many, many years, and was a part of the literary history and has had a number of offices mostly around this North Michigan Avenue area, which when Harriet Monroe started the magazine was the cultural center and bohemian center as well as an architectural spot.
That's exactly right. And in fact, because the magazine never had any money before the Lilly gift, they would often list as their nameplate address in the basement of somebody's brownstone.
Right.
It was donated space,
yeah.
And they moved from place to place. So it was 100 years of migration,
yeah.
Within a several block radius.
Right.
And then the money came and the life changed in many ways. What we did was to take the first 100 days in the job to figure out what we might do to create a strategy of programs which would then be created and people hired, money put to work, that would be a way to carry out the mission that the board of the foundation had set. If I could take a minute, the mission's terribly important. There's two sentences to it. It's very simple. It says the Poetry Foundation is committed to a more vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. That first sentence says that because there's a perception that over the last 100 years, poetry got away from the dinner table. It got away from the high school classroom where you might learn about Shelley, but you might not learn about the wasteland and the modernist kind of poetry, and had become somewhat marginalized in the public discourse. So the hope was that we could take the best poetry now being written and get it back into the cultural mainstream. It was a way to reposition the art form, and we were not the only people doing this. I don't claim that as credit, but we could help, and we had this marvelous gift to help us get the job done. So the second sentence of the mission statement is that it will carry out this commitment by discovering and celebrating the best poetry and placing it before the largest possible audience. Those are key words that guided us in the months and years to come. Best poetry, discover, celebrate, and place before the largest audience. What that really says is that the magazine's single-minded commitment to finding the best poetry you could find and celebrating that with publication would remain our lodestone, our guideline for all the other programs that we were to create in the years to come. The other thing that second sentence says is place it before the largest possible audience. So if you strip away all the fancy words, we're really an outreach organization in many ways. And if you look at our annual budgets, a lot of our money goes into sponsoring programs that would disseminate poetry around the country. It could be public television, could be public radio, it could be in various publications. So that was our marching orders from the
right.
board.
Now, you could have done that, of course, structurally initially in a number of ways. I imagine one of the first decisions you had to make was, were you going to be an operating foundation or a grant-making foundation? Maybe there even were other options.
There may be. I haven't checked with the IRS recently. But, that's exactly right. The board had to choose between those two options. And when you get a big load of money like that and go for tax-exempt status, you need to declare yourself either one or the other. the household name foundations like the Ford, the Pew, the MacArthur tend to be the grant makers. Mm-hmm. And so they have a battery of experts who would evaluate many, many proposals in given areas of interest and then award financial contributions to help those forward. An operating foundation is different. We go out and we create our programs. We hire our own people to run them, and we're like a company. Right. That was the way the board chose to go, and I think it turned out to be a very wise choice. So we are an operating foundation with about 25 employees. We're located in our new digs, which you know well, Andrew, over at the corner of Dearborn and Superior. And we have been putting together the programs for the last 10 years.
Let's walk through those different areas and programs. We don't need to spend a lot of time on the jewel in the crown, which is Poetry Magazine, not because it's not worth talking about and not because you don't have ideas about it, but because we have spent a couple programs with Chris Wyman, the editor. We'll be talking soon with Don Scher. And of course, it's there. If you pick up a copy of Poetry, yes, it now has illustrations and so on, perhaps nicer cover stock, but it's still that Poetry Magazine that you remember from the shelves of your school library or from your own subscription, and it still follows the open door policy of Harriet Monroe, and it still surprises with, in fact, the current issue, the summer issue, is from and all about certain aspects of Afghanistan.
Exactly right. And the magazine continues to reinvent itself every time I turn around. In the most recent example would be the June issue, which happens to be the last issue that Chris Wyman has personally edited before he goes on to his rewards at Yale University. The magazine has experimented in the same way and same spirit that Harriet Monroe did 100 years ago when she founded it. But as you say, that was a specific thing with 90 years of history when I showed up. And it was wonderfully important because it set an aesthetic standard that we could build on with our other programs.
Right.
I've often joked that if this money had come to us from a successful used car dealer in Michigan, I'm making this up, and had sort of parachuted in, and there was no magazine to tie it to, it would not have been taken seriously in the poetry mm-hmm. community. The mm-hmm. attitude would have been, what do they know about poetry?
Right.
And with truth, I mean, it would have been accurate to ask that question. But the magazine is tremendously legitimate in terms of discovering, often for the first time, publishing virtually every significant poet in the language.
So it's really an anchor and a foundation as well as a jewel. It's all of those.
Yeah, it's all of those. And to give you an example, a lot of our strategic planning, if I may use that word, was to think of other major venues than the printed word, the printed page, but we could take poetry of that quality.
Right.
So one of our early decisions was to create a website. We did what I could call a reality check on our early thinking about strategy by commissioning a study from an affiliate of the University of Chicago to go out and actually help us figure out where poetry sits in American culture. Again, I joke about it, but everybody in the poetry world, I believe, is completely sure they know where poetry sits based on the reading they went to last night.
Right.
So it's all anecdotal, and nobody ever done something of a social science nature.
Right.
So we actually conducted thousands of interviews. We had meetings with stakeholders. We had focus groups, and then a book was written about it, which is available on our website, free for the downloading. But what it found became very informative for us as to where to place our resources to get more poetry out before the public. One example would be the web. The internet was 10 years younger 10 years ago, and people were not going to it for their poetry in the amounts that they could. So we thought that's an opportunity. There were already some excellent poetry websites out there, but we thought maybe we could build one with a very large archive at its heart,
right,
and invite people to come and get their poetry online. So that website is now the biggest of its kind. It has 10,000 poems in its archive, Theirs are all bought and paid for. We have a group of editors that does nothing but negotiate intellectual property rights for programs like that. And I describe the archive as an Oxford English anthology free for the downloading. Right. You can go to any poem you want and download it.
You all really were ahead of the curve, even though I'm sure over the years there have been things changed, tweaked, reformatted, but you were really ahead of the curve with the comprehensive nature, I think. I remember looking at it in its early days and feeling overwhelmed and just thinking, as you said, well, I'm not going to read a poem on the even though I was writing on computers and using them. And we each go through these changes as the technology changes, but that decision to really make a visual and a archival presence from the beginning probably proved to be a good one.
I think so, because basically we just got on a train that was leaving the station called the Internet,
yeah.
And we rode with that. All of our programs together will get our selected poems out to about 30 million people that would not otherwise have seen or heard them. And when I showed up, the outreach was the magazine with about 11,000 subscribers. Yeah. So that's the part of the mission that we measure by.
Yeah. So there was the magazine and is. There was and is the website, which also includes oral, A-U-R-A-L, sides to it. You've got podcasts.
We do. We have poetry videos. We have podcasts. So it's a sort of a multidimensional, very fancy website. With friendly navigation. So if someone says, you know, I got to find a wedding toast and I don't do poetry, you could basically search our website and find a complete selection of wedding poems to read at a wedding.
What were some of the other things that you found in that major survey? And what were the things, if any, that surprised you the most or in retrospect surprised you still?
Well, we also learned about demographics. Mm-hmm. And so we learned that not every age group of Americans comes to their poetry in the same way. And we thought it was important for us to try to design some programs that would be particularly attuned or directed toward young readers. The reason is we found out from the fusion groups, the focus groups, we would ask these people, and we'd be watching behind a one-way mirror, how did you come to your poetry? And they didn't know it was us that was sponsoring the study. And so often the answer came back, my high school English teacher or my mother, right. Somebody around the family.
Yeah.
So we realized from this that poetry's best chance to get a lifetime lover of poetry is to get them when they're young.
Right.
So we, in fact, directed two programs, which I'll take a minute to describe,
please,
if I may. About this time in the early months of getting going on all this, we got a visit from the head of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's a fine poet and critic named Dana Gioia.
And Dana was also somebody who followed a business path, although not as quite as intense. But, I mean, it was an intense period he had,
yes,
in the business world. But it wasn't necessarily as long of a period. But I think he was with General Mills. Is that
General Foods.
General Foods. All right. Well, I knew it was one of the generals.
That's very good. And, in fact, a great anecdote. He was the product manager for Jell-O. And he has some hilarious stories about that.
I can imagine. And he is, as you say, both a wonderful poet and critic of poetry and society.
He is. And in fact, what he did at the NEA was remarkable.
Yeah.
He took an organization that was in some trouble and turned it into a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But he called me up and said, let's have a cup of coffee. I've got an idea. And I, with two of my colleagues, we met him here in Chicago. And he said, why don't we start a recitation program together, collaborate, for high school students? And it won't be the kids reciting their own work, which is a welcome thing, but it will be a contest in which they memorize three poems from an anthology we will create. So they might pick a poem by Jonathan Swift, Allen Ginsberg, or William Butler Yeats, Shakespeare, whatever. And then they perform those on stage in competition. So they're graded as to accuracy, dramatic presentation, understanding the poem by judges. And it's modeled on the National Spelling Bee, but instead of dealing in words, they deal in memorized poems. And it's a wonderful program. It's now 8 or 9 years old. It grew from nothing to 350,000 students last year, all voluntary. And at this point in time, it's reached over 2 million high school students, over 2,000 high schools.
I was extremely fortunate, as my peers were, to have 7th and 8th grade, as they called it for a period, a language arts teacher. And she was of the old school, and so we're talking about in the early 1970s, she was having us, on top of everything else we had to do, term papers, book reports, group book reports, class reading, memorize, I think it was three or four per year, and they had to be over, I think, 40 lines. So these were really adventures, and I'm sure that much of the pleasure that we all later took from poetry came from having that intense experience. Sometimes, of course, I remember the time I'd totally forgotten, and I thought I could get away with the night before Christmas, but I could memorize it in an hour and a half. Well, I couldn't, and of course, she knew every poem.
So, oh my gosh.
Which is Florence Stein. And so when I read about this project starting, I was very excited. It's my own fault. I haven't arranged to follow it individually, but to see the kids, the winners, they come from the range of all 50 states and every background. Yeah,
exactly right. And it is a magical thing when people see it for the first time, to see these young people living a poem. And what we love about it is that those poems become their friends for life.
Right.
In the same way that you memorized 40-line poems that you could probably still recite because you were 16.
A few lines. Oh, no, we were 11, 12, and 13.
Oh, even better.
And then the other youth program you were going to mention.
The other youth program is called the Children's Poet Laureate.
Right.
And that was something new. There's a lot of poets laureate in the country. There's the Library of Congress does the big one, the U.S., but even county fairs have their poets laureate. So we thought, gee, why not create one for children's writers? So the idea is to raise the level of visibility and recognition for a very important kind of poetry written by adult poets for children, because that's the future of poetry.
Right.
If we don't develop future generations of readers, there's not going to be any readership for poetry 20 years from now.
Right. You had one prize that also came, or one major prize and two smaller prizes that also came from the beneficence of Miss Lilly, and that was the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, and then some scholarships, I guess you could say, for younger writers at the magazine. And you took these and expanded them and made a whole set of Pegasus Prizes.
Exactly right. And I had an experience because I'd served for a lot of years on the boards of poetry organizations elsewhere in the country. And what happens is they tend to accumulate a lot of prizes that are just for excellence. And there's someone's spouse died and there's a modest amount of money that's given in their name. And there is no particular focus to those. And I thought there was an opportunity to create a family of prizes with a shared objective of inviting attention to the under-recognized and under-illuminated corners of the poetry world, both kinds of poetry and poets themselves. So over a year or two, we invented the Neglected Master Award, where we basically work with the Library of America to publish a poet who's been writing all their lives. They're a master, but they're under-recognized.
Yeah.
The first prize went to Samuel Menage, and the second to Ann Stevenson.
Yeah.
And we don't plan to give this every year.
Right. You have to be neglected, but also very good.
Right? Exactly right.
You can't just say, I'm neglected. I'll never forget my first meeting with Samuel Menage and my radio program with him later, a person who just he lived for poetry, and that was it. I mean, he had his one-room apartment
exactly.
and his bathtub,
which
was his desk as well. And he recited. He was a great reciter of
all of his
poems, and just such a special person. And and Miss Stevenson also has her own story. But so that was one area. Then humor, I think, was another area.
We invented an award called the Mark Twain Award for Humor in American Poetry. And the idea behind that is that I would say that American poetry has yet to produce its Mark Twain mm-hmm. in the form of a poet, although there's some contenders,
right.
Billy Collins, Tony Hoagland, and others. So
sure.
There's some wonderful verse. But what the award seeks to address is the fact that sometimes people confuse serious as in sober with serious as in good. And I think there's a difference. So
sure.
our point of the award is that there can be terribly good quality poetry that is humorous in nature, just like Huckleberry Finn.
And then you walked into the Lion's Den with a criticism award, right? Awarded, at least the first one is equal to probably the prickliest critic of poetry.
Yes, we did.
William Logan.
Yes,
right?
William Logan did. When he stood up to receive it on the Millennium stage, he said, "What were they thinking?"
But it is important to remind people that critics are a part of the organic nature of the poem. They're the mediators, they're the proponents, they're the opponents, but they're the ones who connect us with it. And some of them are poets themselves, Eliot, of course, being the great critic poet.
Absolutely right. And you can broaden that point a bit to say that controversy in poetry is of its nature. If you look at the history of evolution of new schools, the Romantics were turning on the Augustan poets to do it some other way. The modernists turned on the Romantics so that Pound and Eliot were representing a new way of writing poetry and a new way to think about it all. So I think poetry arises from a continuous process of what they now call creative destruction.
Right.
And so we get a lot of that in the magazine. The back end of the magazine in terms of the letters to the editor is fiery, filled with people that have strong opinions.
And fortunately, the emphasis has been on creative, at least in this creative destruction. We'll leave aside where it sometimes happens in the business world for another time. We're speaking with John Barr, who has spent years in the business world, has spent a lifetime in the poetry world, and for the last 10 years has spent time in the world of the Poetry Foundation based here in the city of Chicago. And we say based here, that was another one of the challenges you all faced. Where was your home going to be, and what kind of a home was it going to be? And tell us a bit about that.
One of the components of our strategy, which was made up of the programs we proposed to create to carry out the mission of the Poetry Foundation, one of those was to build a building. We had rented space. It was very nice space, but there was no way to—
After you left the health club building.
You
did have nice space on Michigan Avenue.
a quick story. You mentioned Christian Wyman, who's the editor of the magazine. We were sitting around this table in the unheated walk-up, and I said, we're going to have to build a building, I think, if the board agrees, and it's going to take 4 or 5 years. It took longer, as it turned out, and— Chris Wyman, his body language is wonderful. All he just gave us a grimace and said, "That's really grim." So the idea of spending 5 years in that walk-up was more than any of us could take. So we found some beautiful space on Michigan Avenue, but it was a high-rise, and there was no way to produce public programming out of that. So we proceeded with a plan, which the board thought highly of, to hire an architect, find a piece of land in this area of Chicago, buy the land, design the building, and then build the building. And if I may just summarize that project, it took longer than we thought because we had all the drawings. We had hired the architect. We were set to go. And then the financial crisis of 2008 came along. And we went to our board and said, we're ready to break ground, but we think we should put this on the shelf because we don't know where the bottom of this financial crisis is. So we, about 18 months, just held up on it. It turned out to be a good move because the construction business is very cyclical, and you can get better prices for the same work if you're not bidding against other people.
Sure.
Well, We rebid the project and saved about $300,000 because of the delay we took. And we found a piece of land that we bought in the corner of Dearborn and Superior. And we hired a wonderful architect named John Ronan, who is a member of the newer generation of architects in Chicago. And this project was a big moment for him and a huge moment for us. So we worked together beautifully, I would say.
And he's somebody who has been very much involved with socially connected projects. So he's worked with the Comers in the Grand Crossing and Southside areas with schools and youth projects. And he's just somebody who sees things inside and outside, I think. And that, of course, is what he proposed to you, was an inside and outside building. Describe the building.
I will, and I'd love to. But there's a story, it may be apocryphal, that Frank Lloyd Wright never listened to his clients. But in John's case, he was the exact opposite. He sat down with each one of us one-on-one and said, what are you thinking? What are your visions for the building? And what came out of those was a notion that here's an opportunity to build essentially the first building ever from the ground up about poetry. So we invited John to think of the building as a metaphor and that the building would work the way a poem works, so that when you walk into the building, it's like reading the first line of a poem, and as you walk through the building, you continue to experience the way a poem would work. This is not in a silly way. We don't have any lines of poetry, which we'd get tired of after a week, up on the walls. John Ronan likes to say that his building doesn't seek to answer questions, it seeks to ask them. And by creating a series of experiences as you walk through the building, you come back wishing you want to come back for more and understand more. And that's the effect it's had on our public. It's been wonderfully received.
One of the questions I think that the building asks, and I like this about it, and each time I've been here, which is a number of times, I've had to pause for a moment to think, where's the entrance? But in a way, that's a good thing because it's not hidden, but it's sort of hidden in plain sight. And in a way, that's another metaphor, isn't it, about picking up a poem?
It's a beautiful example.
It's not being put right into your mouth or right into your ear or your eye. There's a moment of, okay, I'm stepping into somewhere else. And then you walk into an area with trees and glass, and you wonder, am I inside or am I outside?
Precisely. John did not put the entrance where it should be, which is in the middle of the block. He put it at one extreme end. There's no signage, so there's no address. So as you walk up, there's a bit of mystery the way a new poem would present itself. And the only thing you get is on the sidewalk at your feet, you see Poetry Foundation, yeah, but nothing else. As you walk into the courtyard, you can't do it in a straight line. It's a little bit like reading the first line of a Frost poem. And what you see ahead of you is a double wall of books, so you know it will be a literary experience.
Right.
You're so right, Andrew, to say that John Ronan likes to play with ideas of inside and outside. And so the flooring runs directly under the walls of glass so that you, in fact, optically have to take a moment and say, am I inside or outside?
Right. And when you're inside and you're in the library space, which is a public space, you're on stones and you're having to check yourself. And that's – we need to do that, right? I mean, a space that I miss terribly, I don't know if you overlap with it at all, was the original – junior museum space at the Art Institute of Chicago. It was in the basement, and one of the things about it was everything was built down to a child's level.
Beautiful.
So the library, which ran around all the walls of a room, was stopped at about 2.5 feet high. And the furnishings and the sit-down spaces. I notice you all have some spots, it looks like, for a story time or something. I'm not quite sure what those are. Are they giant sponges?
Yeah.
There's something for kids to sit on, I'm guessing.
Exactly right. They're low cork stools that look like they might eat you if you sat on them.
So there's that idea of a bit of humor and a bit of liveliness. There's also the feeling of blank pieces of paper, which is what the poet starts with wherever he or she starts, right? And those are the walls,
those are the walls.
Non-glass and
exactly.
Non-see-through walls.
And because there's so much glass in the building, John created a lot of back views. You can see into two or three other rooms or spaces.
Right.
That's a little bit the way the lines of a poem would comment on each other as you work your way through a poem. That's the back bearings and the forward bearings. So in many ways, it's a perfect metaphor for the way a poem works, and I like to say that John Ronan's building is the word of poetry made the flesh of architecture.
Yeah, I think you're right. Key to all of this, of course, are the public programs and the idea of containing not all but most of them under the roof of what would become your building. And a lot of neat ideas about what kind of a space those readings and so on should happen in. And tell us about that because it's also, again, it worked.
It worked. We invited John to bring in acoustical engineers and design the most perfect space that science could devise for the sound of a human voice reading a poem. or reciting a poem.
That sounds very simple, and it's not, because we live in a world of microphones and amplification and earbuds and headphones and tape recorders and cameras and dot, 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 dot. We all have 2,000 of these things, or we're exposed to them. And, but this was the idea of a person reading a poem to an audience.
So it wasn't designed for grand opera. It wasn't designed for a symphony. It was designed for one voice speaking. And your list of interruptions is wonderful. It also includes street traffic outside.
Yeah, right.
So we're on a busy street, Dearborn and Superior. And what John came up with does the job. It's got three layers of heavy glass between us and the street traffic. It has non-reflective, non-echoing floor, ceiling, walls. And I think people, I would argue it might be the finest space I know of anywhere for this particular use of a poet reading. And poets love to recite in there.
It seats how many?
It seats 120, and that was also not accidental. When we were planning the building, we did an audit of poetry reading spaces in this part of Chicago. And we found that if we need a big auditorium, we can do that at the Art Institute. If we need a very small one, you know, we can go somewhere else. But 120 with a few more standing room is just right.
And again, there's a visual side because of the glass, the wood, the other aspects. There's a, you're put at comfort, you're put at ease. And ready to be surprised, I guess,
exactly,
when you're in that space.
Could I mention one
Please.
More thing about the way that the building as a whole has brought a kind of energy to the foundation I never could have expected as president? It was full of energy before, but the building gives a physical presence to poetry in Chicago. And it's part of the cultural landscape. It was embraced by the people of Chicago. So we're thrilled with the fact that that has happened. And a quick example of what I mean would be that if you follow poetry, we all know poetry readings where you go and the turnout is not overwhelming.
Right.
But we have more sellout evenings in our space than I ever would have expected.
It's very, very special. We're going to post as well on our website, but I'm just going to mention right now both poetryfoundation.org, which is easy to remember and takes you to all the aspects of the foundation and the magazine, and also John Ronan, the architect, J.R. Arch, as in architecture, J.R.A.R.C.H., jrarch.com, jrarch.com, and poetryfoundation.org will show you these things. But also, if you're in or near Chicago, you can come to the building, both to use the library and to look at the building and for these many programs. And we should say it's not wholly hidden. There's also a glass with some monthly etching or seasonal etching, I guess, that tells you about the programs. And we should mention Steve Young, who has carried on probably every job that's existed because he comes from before the days of The Gift, and he was an editor of the magazine. He was a transition person. He's put book collections together, and he's created and run public programs. So
he's wonderful.
And a lovely person.
He's a lovely person, and Steve is the director of all our programming. So he has come up with the endlessly good ideas about which poets to invite and what kind of poetry events to create. Mm. And then he also represents our role in Poetry Out Loud, the National High School Recitation Contest. So we wouldn't be here without Steve.
These are all things that we've talked about that either are directly presented to the public, directly accessible to the public, even physically accessible. Then there's another pillar column section that exists in some ways in space and in other ways in people's heads, and then eventually in a form that many people who are interested can come in contact with, and that's this Poetry Institute. Now, this was, of all the things you threw out initially, I think the one that raised the most eyebrows or caused the most questions from outside people.
And it was a hard thing to define. When you create something and call it an institute, they say, where's the building? Where's the bricks and mortar? Because that's what institutes are. This is actually an institute of the mind. And it was and is intended to be the Aspen-style think tank for poetry. But it's not as big as the Aspen Institute. We have a director whom is appointed by the president every couple of years, and then a small staff internally dedicated to keeping that going. The mission of the Institute is to address questions of intellectual and practical importance to poetry that other people don't have the resources to do. An example would be the first book that the Institute commissioned and created was about intellectual property rights for poets. And it tried to identify best practices for poets that say, how should I feel about seeing my poem online and I didn't get paid for it?
Right. Or on a bus and I didn't get paid for it.
Exactly.
On the one hand, wow, people see my poem and my name is spelled right. On the other hand, I worked my tail off and I didn't get a penny.
That's right? Exactly right. And we try to address those in a, you know, in a useful way. There are now about six books that either are or have come out of the foundation on a variety of topics. And
what's the most recent?
Poetry for Children. Mm-hmm. There's one called The Open Door, which is based on Harriet Monroe's famous editorial policy. There's a book that came out recently on translation. I'll just take a minute on that one because I thought about this one myself. If you look at the evolution of the history of poetry in America, it has had various periods when a non-U.S. kind of poetry comes in and has a major effect. Think of the Latin American poets in the 80s, Borges and the others. They were Spanish language poets.
Octavio Paz, yeah.
Paz would be another one, Neruda.
Right.
That was a big moment for how American poets wrote that changed. Another one would be Milos and the Central European poets when they came in.
Right.
So my question to the world at large is, what is the next influence center that will come into this country? And is there a way that the foundation can use its resources to invite that process? So the Institute has written a book, which is just coming out.
Wow.
About that's interviews with poets that write very differently from other cultures. And the question is, will any of those grab hold and be the next Neruda?
Oh, interesting. So I think you can see and you can hear, and again, the proof of the pudding is in the publication. You can read these books online in many cases. You can see them for free at the Poetry Foundation Library, open to the public, or you can purchase them as well. But what you can see is that there were concerns. One said, I would say, that this was all going to be very airy-fairy, this Harriet Monroe Institute, and others that it was all going to be, let's corporatize poetry.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid the critics were wrong, because just from these topics, you can hear that these are things, maybe each one is not of interest to everyone, but each of them is interesting, and each of them takes up a set of questions that are important either to the writer of poetry, the translator, the publisher, the consumer, which is what we do. We consume things.
We do indeed.
So I have to say, that was one when I read that first of your annual letters, and we mentioned last program, that one of the things I do admire greatly about John Barr, and there are many, as you've been able to tell over these past couple of programs, are that he's willing to lay things out. He puts out this annual letter of ideas, of challenges, of goals met, of reporting on goals still set. And I think that's a brave thing, but also in this case, it's clearly a well-organized, determined person who's willing to. And then, of course, you get feedback, right? You get letters.
Yes.
Not just the magazine, right?
And they're not all love letters.
They're not all love letters. So, and that then appears in your next report, where you give a sense of how these things are flying.
Somewhere in ancient literature, I think it could have been the letters of Seneca, but I'm not sure. There's a moment where the mentor is advising a young person who's deciding about a major decision in his life. And the question, innocent on the face of it, from the mentor is, do you want to be liked or do you want to make a difference?
Right.
And so I think the foundation has tried hard to respect all the poetry that's written. But it's also been forced by constraints that nobody can be all things to all people,
right,
to make choices and decisions.
And it's a good thing that you're somebody who cares about things like Seneca, because I'm sure that there have been hits. There was a New Yorker magazine article that had some things right and other things not so right. It wasn't the kindest piece of work ever done. And there have been other things, and there have been questions of personnel and other things that come along. But when you have your sense of who you are and your sense of what you're doing, not in a maniacal way, because we didn't have a chance to test you on that. You didn't have any big failures. So, but we know many an organization where something doesn't work and it's Ahab. No, we're just going to keep going and going and going. In this case, it's sort of been, trust me, I'm listening to you, and here's where we're going. And the test has been, as you say, a great acceptance of the seriousness of the project and an increase in circulation of the magazine and the growth of the website. Sold out programs. And these are all fine things. It's not a popularity contest, but there's a popular element. There's a vote, there's a participation, and you can show that that's happened. I know this would be at least another hour, but I'm going to ask you to stand on one foot and tell us of the angels on the head of the pin. Poetry when you arrived and poetry today, the field, at least in our country, not only the magazine. Where do you see things having gone over this 10 years?
Oh, that's a great question. And the related question is, did we have anything to do, good or bad, with it?
Sure.
I believe that there has been progress made toward getting poetry back into a general readership. When modernist poetry was born in the early part of the 20th century, it migrated from the dinner table of Wordsworth and Longfellow into the classroom. And so the academic world became a home for poetry that was much more difficult and challenging. I mean the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I mean the language poets. I mean poetry that's very challenging and not necessarily something you would curl up with at night in front of a warm fire in the winter. Nevertheless, it's the poetry that our country is creating. And the question is, how do you get it to the most people that would find it useful to their lives? So our work has been, along with other poetry organizations, to help every poet and every poem find its largest intended audience. Not every poet writes to be Billy Collins or a Longfellow. I think it's wonderful that we have those people writing. But there's also an element of degree of difficulty, if you will. And so our work in promoting poetry has been to try to apply a general appreciation. Nothing, we're not identified with any school of poetry. It's not formalism or anything else. Let me just offer one way in which we assure that we get a broad look at poetry. The editorial function at the foundation is highly decentralized. So I don't sit around and say to Chris Wyman, why did you publish that poem?
Right.
I've never said that in 9 years. And so what we do is create a structure which is where the programs each have a senior editor and they do their work. So we have 6 or 8 different people in the foundation that make independent decisions every day about poetry that moves them and that they would like to share with their outlets and their venues and their audience.
What are you most concerned about after you leave this job in terms of poetry?
I think there will be a challenge of success as opposed to a challenge of failure. Here's my dream for poetry. The term starving artist has entered the language, and that would certainly include poets. Poetry was known for not having any money. We are extremely honored to have this gift come for us to be the stewards to put it to work for poetry. It doesn't change things in the face of it, but if the work we do through our program is successful, we can see an economic substance come back into the business of publishing poetry. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. Rather than us writing a grant check, we do that with the fellows, the Lilly Fellows. But instead of sending all our money out the door in forms of grants to poets, we would like to promulgate, advertise, and celebrate the poems so that somebody hearing it on the radio says, I like that poem. I'm going to go on Amazon or my local bookstore and buy the book. That jumpstarts an economic cycle. Well, publishers say, I can sell books. I'll publish this. So we would like to sort of jumpstart the engine of poetry, not as an art form that's too small to matter, but an art form that is so embedded in the culture that, in fact, people can succeed at it. And most important, it enriches the lives of the people that write it and read it.
One could say that's all better than well and good. It's great. This is happening at a time when publishing is in such a unknown area and direction, when the monetization and lack of monetization of any kind of writing, newspapers, magazines, other than Poetry Magazine, of, you know, here we've got WFMT standing tall and Poetry Magazine standing tall while business publications and other things crumbling. So these are, it's an interesting time to figure out how to make an internet world, also a world where an author can be compensated and a writer can be both read and respected. These are hard ones.
They are hard ones, and I think the work that you do at WFMT and the work that we do at the Poetry Foundation has one thing going for it, which is missed in the market for business textbooks, and it's this. Poetry lovers tend to want to own their poems in acid-free paper, printed beautifully between covers. And so the way I put this point is that if the day comes, I hope it never does, where the ebook replaces all the books in your library, the last shelf to go will be those beautiful poems.
I think you're right.
And the reason I think it's that linkage exists is because poetry's passion is for permanence. A poet writes a poem to create something that will last forever in a world where nothing lasts forever. That's the mad obsession of poets. Emily Dickinson writing for a future and an audience she didn't even know existed.
Now, you had to have not only an exit interview with Critical Thinking on WFMT, I imagine there was probably a last meeting of the board of directors of the Poetry Foundation and some work that had to be done to get the new fellow started July 1 and to say goodbye to you as of June 30.
Indeed. In fact, yesterday I had my farewell meeting with the board, and they were wonderful, both in saying goodbye to me and welcoming Robert Polito as the next president. I had a short statement I wanted to make to the board, and perhaps I could share it with you, Andrew. It says, writing poetry is among the most solitary of human endeavors. As Dylan Thomas put it, in my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for ambition or bread, or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. The Poetry Foundation brings poets to their readers so that both may receive their common wages.
John Barr, making us think about poetry, but also making us think about it from, and I hope you won't mind my saying this, a distinctly Midwestern origin, that optimism, that idea of hard work. These are things that attracted Harriet Monroe and that shaped and attracted you and that have enabled you to, this extraordinary gift from Ruth Lilly, to leave a tremendous legacy in these institutions that come under the cover of the Poetry Foundation, and that all of which propel more people to poetry and more poets to other people. And I think that's something that you can and should feel great about. I hope we won't be losing you altogether in terms of your Chicago residence. I know you've got other roots in the East Coast and family and so on, but you've been such a part of our lives here quietly, but importantly, and now perhaps even more so through your own writing and your own poetry. But It's been a pleasure both of 10 years and for these 2 hours of conversation.
Thank you so much, Andrew. We will stay in Chicago. We love this city, and we are Midwestern. Thank you.
No, we won't think noble because we're not noble. We won't live in beautiful harmony because there's no such thing in this world, nor should there be. We promise only to do our best and live out our lives. Dear God, that's all we can promise in truth. Marry me, Cunegonde.
So have I, but come and be my wife, and let us try before we die to make some sense of life. And chop our wood and make our garden grow and make our garden
opened and closed today's program with music of Leonard Bernstein and lyrics of some wonderful American collaborators of this great American composer and musicalist who were themselves among our greatest wordsmiths and poets. We started off with the president's wife singing, "Take Care of This House," from the ill-fated 1976 musical 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, a show that deserves to be seen and heard, and certainly this song, Take Care of This House, is heard. Lyrics are by Alan J. Lerner, and this is from a 1998 song recording, the great Marilyn Horn and the great collaborative pianist Martin Katz. And we closed with the finale, Make Our Garden Grow, from the original Candide, whose lyrical hands included Dorothy Parker, John Latouche, and Richard Wilbur, a winner of the Lilly Prize during the period of John Barr and Chris Wyman at Poetry. And Leonard Bernstein himself contributed lyrics here and there as well. Richard Ronsville and Barbara Cook from the 1956 legendary original Broadway cast recording. We'd like to thank, of course, John Barr and Kristen Gakin of the Poetry Foundation for making this interview happen and making it happen again so that we could bring it to you this evening. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano, as ever, for putting this program together with us and making it sound great. Our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. We recorded this program at the Poetry Foundation at their wonderful building that we discussed with you today. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line, rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com, or chime in at WFMT.com or WFMT at Facebook. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can hear this program or any of our programs again anytime on the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.